Across the United States, age-old racism and inequities are once again gaining the public's attention with movements like Black Lives Matter. In Minnesota, when it comes to disease, school dropouts, incarceration, Native Americans endure some of the greatest racial disparities in the state. But there is work being done in towns across the state to take on these disparities. Towns like Bemidji, a small city in Minnesota's North Woods. Here, Natives and non-Natives have been working for decades to focus attention on the root causes of these problems and to forge a new vision for the future. Reporter Melissa Townsend tells the story of their progress. This is the first in a two-part series in the extended edition of Minnesota Native News.
On April 4th, the city of Bemidji hosted the historic Bay-Majigamag Intertribal Powwow. Come on, say it with me. Bay-Majigamag. It's actually Ojibwe for Bemidji. It was a brand new event, the first powwow at the five-year-old Sanford Center. It was the first time fry bread tacos were ever served at the arena's concession stands. It was the first time the city of Bemidji, tribal radio station KOJB, and regional public radio station KBXE ever partnered together on an event to celebrate American Indian culture. Dancers are here hours before it starts. The sounds of their jingle dresses and regalia echo off the concrete floors. It's the first time 79-year-old George Earth has ever been to the Sanford Center. He's from the Leech Lake Reservation.
I've never been here before, but I always thought that it needed some kind of interaction with the community. You know.
By community, he means the large Native American community that lives here. And today, George may be getting what he wanted. 23 drum groups and nearly 500 dancers are signed up to take part in this historic powwow. Raina Hunt and her cousin Roman Rock are here from Cass Lake.
We just come together and it's like family. We see each other. And I mean, I feel like a whole person when I'm with my other people.
Raina doesn't dance, but Roman does.
When I'm out there dancing, nothing else exists. It's just me. It's me dancing for the ancestors from the past, my family that I lost, just trying to make other people happy. And I know I do that because my grandfather, Wally Humphrey, tells me. My aunts, my uncles, my little cousins, when they watch me dance, they're like, my jaw hits the floor.
The place begins to fill up with dancers on the floor and spectators in the stands. There are babies, toddlers, adults, elders. People are excited. This is a celebration. Dolly Bostring from Bostring, Minnesota is psyched about the big crowd.
It's awesome. I'm glad there's a lot of people here, you know, a lot of different, you know, nationalities, different cultures.
A few minutes after one, in front of 3,000 people, the powwow MC Daryl Kingbird gives the word to the host drum.
All right. Young Kingbird, grand entry time, boys. Nagamoto.
And all the dancers and dignitaries dance together in a procession into the arena. For a number of people in the crowd, this is their first powwow, because this event is intended to introduce non-natives to this traditional celebration.
If you are interested in anything that we have, and you guys want to learn about it, we are here to share with each and every one of you. Learn about the peoples that are amongst you here in Bemidji, Bay-Majigamag.
Bemidji resident Kathleen McKinstra says this is an eye-opener for her and her four-year-old daughter, Carol.
We said it's like a live rainbow. The colors, the sounds, the chanting. Boom, boom, boom. And I realize when I come to an event like this how ignorant I am and how much I have yet to learn. But living in Bemidji, I certainly have the resources in my community to start that learning. So it's time to get going on that. So
it's the first Bemidji powwow to host tribal leaders, along with Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton, state representatives, and city council members. Brad Walhoff and Gary Charwood from tribal radio KOJB broadcast live from the event all afternoon.
I think this has been long overdue. I think it's Bemidji saying, hey, We live together. We're a community. Now we need to embrace each other. What do you take from that?
Oh, absolutely, Brad. I believe that just that's a historical moment here in Bemidji.
So today I'm going to be presenting...
Bemidji Mayor Rita Albright gives a traditional tobacco offering and new Pendleton blankets to the three tribal leaders. In exchange, they offer their nation's flags to be hung in the entry hall of the arena. Gary Jones is head of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe.
I want to present the Leech Lake flag to the city of Bemidji to show a symbol of partnership and to continuing efforts building our relationship.
Every Native and non-Native I talked to said this was a big moment.
I took my 81-year-old aunt, who's lived in this area for over 40 years.
Kathy Annette is a citizen of the White Earth Nation, and she grew up on the Red Lake Reservation. She's lived in Bemidji most of her life.
And as we walked in, she was looking all around, and she watched the dancers and the Natives and non-Natives sitting together in the audience and listening to our tribal leaders, the local leaders, the state leaders. And as we were walking out later, she looked at me and said, "Isn't this something? Isn't this something?" You look back 30 years, would you have tribal flags hanging in Bemidji? The answer is no, for a number of reasons. Today, you have tribal flags hanging in Bemidji. It means that our tribal nations are recognized. It means that people in Bemidji have said, these are valued. It's a different time.
This historic Bay Majigamog powwow in Bemidji was years in the making. Over decades, Natives and non-Natives have been struggling to look at a painful past. They've been trying to find ways to coexist as two respected and distinct cultures in one community. Bemidji is a small city along the western shore of Lake Bemidji in the North Woods of Minnesota. The downtown grid is 7 streets wide and 23 streets long. Not that big. The giant statues of the lumberjack Paul Bunyan and his companion Babe the Blue Ox are to the south, and the campus of Bemidji State University is to the north. 15,000 people live here. About 3,000 residents are Native American. That's a really high percentage for a town in Minnesota. This was, of course, at one time all Indian land, mainly associated with the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. But now this predominantly white town sits in the middle of 3 of the largest and most populous Indian reservations in the state. A half an hour north is Red Lake Nation, 15 minutes east is the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, and to the southwest is the White Earth Nation. It's a border town, if there ever was one. And border towns, that is, predominantly white towns sitting on the edge of Indian reservations, are known to have a history of overt exclusion and racism. Seriously, everyone I've talked to say border towns have earned a bad reputation.
Well, I can tell you this.
Lenore Barsness is a citizen of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. She describes herself to me as a light-complected Native American woman.
But I have siblings who are darker complected. I have a mother who is dark complected. So all of my life, I had noticed a difference in how we were treated based on which family members were with me.
She says when they were shopping in Bemidji stores, employees would follow them around to make sure they weren't stealing anything. Anton Troyer is also from Leech Lake. He's a lean, middle-aged man with a braid running all the way down his spine. He says when he was a young person in middle school in Bemidji, he had to deal with racist taunts.
When there were 4 kids sitting around a quad table in the shop class, and I was the only Native at our table, and the kids started in, "Indians are all drunks. Yeah, they're just leeches on the government. Yeah, they're running us dry." And I'd say, "No, that's not true. My mom said," and they'd cut me off. "Your mom just said that because she's a dumb squaw," and they just keep going.
Everything is negative about that experience, whether you're angry or humiliated, intimidated, ashamed.
Kathy Annette, who was at the powwow with her aunt, grew up on the Red Lake Reservation. She remembers a variety of ways Bemidji businesses discriminated against American Indians.
Young men, because they had long hair, these were some of our finest traditional dancers who weren't allowed access to jobs without being told, "You will cut your hair." It was being in line at a grocery store and seeing people getting checks cashed. But when you came up as a Native, and I experienced this, the manager was called to take a look at this. What healthy emotion comes from an experience like that? There is none.
Through her work with the Blandon Foundation, Kathy Annette is acquainted with rural towns across the state. And she says now, Bemidji is at the forefront of race relations work between natives and non-natives. She says Bemidji is leading the way, which made me wonder, how did that happen? The big changes really began in 1966 with two men, Bob Cole,
K-O-H-L,
and Roger Jourdain,
who was tribal chairman at Red Lake at the time.
Anton Troyer and I are going to tell this story. He was that boy in the Bemidji Middle School, but now he's a respected historian, published author, and the director of the American Indian Resource Center at Bemidji State University. He's currently working on a book about Red Lake.
Bob Cole was a radio personality here in Bemidji, and was also hired as publicity director for the freshly minted Bemidji Area Chamber of Commerce.
Cole decided to tour homes of local families who were receiving welfare benefits.
And based upon his personal observations, he then gave a series of three radio programs in which he basically went on a racist rant. And I can pull out a few and just read them to you. In fact, why don't we do it right now? Okay. Oops.
While he's searching his computer for those quotes from the Bemidji Pioneer, let me tell you, Bob Cole's comments are seriously disturbing. I debated whether to even include them here. But I think it's important to hear, one, because this is what Native Americans had to deal with, and two, so you'll understand just what set off the next series of events.
So Cole was at a couple of homes at Red Lake. He described them as indescribably filthy. The people are so low on the human scale that it is doubtful they will ever climb upward. Their satisfaction level is so low that it corresponds to that of the most primitive of Earth's animals. Perhaps we should never have lowered our sights to this level. Perhaps we should have let nature take her course, let disease and malnutrition disrupt the reproductive process, and weed out those at the very bottom of the heap.
Yeah. Disturbing. And Anton Troyer is quoting just one section of one broadcast.
Oh, there's more. Yeah.
Cole did three broadcasts on local radio station KBUN.
So in any event, that didn't go over too well in Indian country.
To say the least.
Roger Jourdain, who was tribal chairman at Red Lake at the time, said enough is enough. Took the issue before the tribal council, and they voted to boycott Bemidji. He communicated with other tribal leaders, and pretty soon Leech Lake joined the boycott and eventually White Earth.
This was huge. Anton estimates American Indians were 50% of shoppers in Bemidji, and overnight, they were gone. Literally, overnight. Cole's broadcast aired on October 24th, 25th, and 26th, and by October 29th, 3 days later, all three tribal nations had blacklisted Bemidji. The tribal governments also threatened to withdraw all their money from Bemidji banks, to the tune of $2 million. This was 1966.
There was an editorial in the Bemidji Pioneer that said the boycott has been so effective and so thorough that over the week, for the first time since Bemidji became a community, Bemidji's streets had been practically devoid of Indians. This is a deplorable situation and one that cannot be allowed to continue. Bemidji cannot long withstand the harmful effects of a strict boycott.
Who wrote that?
That was an editorial in the Bemidji Pioneer. Other people defended Cole. David Umhauer wrote, "I hope that those Indians offended by the broadcast do boycott Bemidji. If they do, it will be a cleaner town."
Roger Jourdain was also writing during this time. His niece Jody Bolio read me some of his quotes from the tribal newspaper, the Red Lake Times. These are dated October 28, 1966.
"We will have to find out who our friends are and act accordingly as to where we spend our money and take our trade. I am sure that any merchant, laundromat, barber shop, bank, auto dealer, and the like, who thinks of us as subhuman, would not want us in their store. We will not force ourselves on anybody. We will go where we are wanted, when it is made known to us that we are wanted. And the best proof of that is not only a smile when we come in through the doors, and another smile when the cash register jingles, but some actual hard support in putting an end to this type of vilification and name-calling."
Jourdain wanted Cole to apologize and then be fired. But that wasn't all he wanted. Jourdain had his eye on the larger picture. In fact, he wanted to deal with nothing less than the economic discrimination and exploitation that had been in place since the founding of Bemidji.
From the arrival of the first white folk in Minnesota, this has been a racially charged atmosphere. The entire timber boom, their ability to obtain gainful employment in the logging industry, you know, and any of the other businesses that were rapidly growing was really, really diminished. Keeping Indians impoverished and denying them opportunity was how they created opportunity for everybody else. When you skip up to Bob Cole, his statements and the economic conditions in the 1960s, well, of course, everything didn't just repair itself overnight.
Bob Cole did apologize.
Cole came up to Red Lake, gave an apology to the tribal council. Of course, everyone at Red Lake heard he was coming, so there were over 200 people at the tribal council meeting.
After the apology, some say Cole was fired. But according to the Red Lake Times, the radio station and the Chamber of Commerce planned to keep him on. But then Roger Jourdain started talking about expanding the boycott, and within a day, Cole had resigned. On November 4th, 7 days after Roger Jourdain organized the boycott, Bemidji Mayor Howard Menge met with him to talk about that larger picture.
I think the mayor was really trying to find a way to make things better. Roger Jourdain said, well, to really make things better, you need to address economic opportunities, and this isn't something that'll happen overnight. A lot of people have a lot of learning to do. And so they ended up creating an organization, and they called it the Community Relations Commission. And this was really the first effort in the Bemidji region to look at some sort of racial reconciliation and be intentional about it.
There was a big push to train regional business owners and employees on cultural competencies so more Native people would be hired. Joe Lucan was a white man who owned Lucan's Grocery Stores, a small local chain. He set up an affirmative action program and successfully put many new Native employees on a management track.
I've personally seen him show up at a couple of powwows and be given honor songs, and they call out everybody to come shake his hand.
Lucan's commitment notwithstanding, Anton says the momentum from the boycott and the formation of this new coalition lasted for relatively a short time.
I think some Native people got disillusioned with a pace of change that was too slow. And I think some white folk got scared. It was just not comfortable.
It took until about, I think, 2005 when we really coalesced with a group to improve race relations.
Rita Albright is the current mayor of Bemidji, but in 2005 she wasn't in government. She was just Rita. So Rita, who is not Native, and a few other volunteers started a new organization called Shared Vision. She says they wanted to take a more proactive approach. So in 2009, the group worked with researchers from the Wilder Foundation to survey people in the Bemidji area. The survey went directly after something most people wanted to avoid, tough questions about race and life in Bemidji.
And that was an eye-opener for us.
One question asked, do you feel the Bemidji area is a welcoming community to people of all races?
There was a disconnect between how Indians viewed, you know, the community and how whites viewed the community.
To be specific, 88% of white residents said the Bemidji area is welcoming, and 73% of Native Americans said it was not. Lenore Barsness, that light-complected Native American woman from Leech Lake, she says this documentation of the Native experience was a very big deal. Lenore says before the survey, it didn't feel like reports of racism were taken seriously.
They say, did you write it up? Did you investigate? Did they do this or did they do that? How do we know that's true?
So what you do is you ignore the felt experience that people have.
In fact, she says the survey probably would have been ignored too if it weren't for the white allies who were working alongside the natives to make it a big deal.
Would that have been attended to as well if it had been an all-native group of people sponsoring that research? The fear is that it would not be.
This was in 2010, so 34 years after the tribes boycotted Bemidji over racism. This new alliance of natives and non-natives brings this issue to the fore again. The majority of American Indians felt unwelcome in Bemidji. That feeling was partly because of the overt prejudice and racial hostility shared earlier, but it was also because American Indians felt invisible. People I talked to said when you looked around town, there was no indication that Native Americans lived here, when in fact, many, many Natives lived here. There's no community awareness of culture, traditions, history, of the strong sovereign nations just beyond the town's northeast and west borders.
You know, either we're not here, or we're criminals, or we're drunks, or we're romanticized.
Simone Senegals is from the Red Lake Nation, and she grew up in Bemidji. Her son was in elementary school around the time of the survey. She says even young people like her boy experienced this.
He was, I think, a third grader, and one of our family members was going into his school to sing on hand drum for the kindergarten class. And so the kindergarten teacher asked my son, will you come and introduce your person, you know, or to let the kindergarten class know what's coming. And so my son was in there talking about, okay, well, he's going to come and sing a song, and, you know, he sings on a hand drum. And there's this little kindergarten girl, and she was saying, we're really going to see an Indian? We're going to see a real Indian? We're going to see a real Indian? And she was really excited. And my son stopped, and he looked at her, and he said, you're looking at one right now. You're talking to a real Indian right now.
Mayor Albright says this is part of what that group, Shared Vision, wanted to change. In 2010, they started to look for ways to engage more Native Americans in the community.
For example, on board service, nonprofit service, commissions, all of that. We recognized, you know, we don't have a lot of diversity around the table.
And they also wanted to find ways to teach non-natives about Ojibwe culture.
Which means Gathering Cloud is my name and I am from Bemidji. And that's a very common way for people to introduce themselves along with their clan.
Michael Mears is a white Irish man who has been working with the Red Lake Nation for just over 20 years. And he was part of the Shared Vision Group with Mayor Albright. The Ojibwe Language Project was partly his idea. It's a movement by the group Shared Vision to put Ojibwe signage in public places around Bemidji. He's popping Nicorette gum as we drive the streets of downtown Bemidji, looking at the low-slung storefronts. We're on 3rd Street, and I see Royce Comics, the Senior Center, and the Cabin Cafe.
This cabin is the first place that posted Ojibwe signage. It says, you can see it, Anin Bouju, on the door there.
Yeah.
It's a tidy little storefront with a faux wood facade meant to make it look, well, like a log cabin. Michael says he told a few people about the idea of having Ojibwe signs around Bemidji, and they didn't think it would fly.
We were sitting in, somebody telling me that it would never work. We were sitting in the cabin, and I said, I'll tell you what, I'll go and ask the owner right now. So I went up and I asked the owner if it was her daughter, it wasn't her, that I'd like to them to post Ojibwe signage, you know, Ikwewak and Ininiwak on the restroom doors. And I don't know, a month later I came back and they had that on the front door, that Buju Anin. And all of a sudden, I gotta fulfill now.
He said he would buy the signs for the first 10 people who posted it.
And I figured, well, I'll get 20 or so, I don't know. And while I was walking down the street, and I had 20 before you could shake a stick, you know. And it was easy. And
the idea spread like wildfire. Muir said all the schools and over 150 businesses now have Ojibwe signage.
The Bemidji Co-op has got a lot of their foods marked in Ojibwe. Naylor Electric has, so they don't exist anymore, but for a time they had television, washers and dryers. Everything was marked in Ojibwe.
What's the impact, do you think, of the Ojibwe signs?
It tells the the Indians around here, the Ojibwe people, it tells them that we want your business. We respect you. We respect you and your culture. And it teaches the non-Indian a little bit about the culture that was here before 1895.
There's one other reaction to Ojibwe signs that you might not expect. Michael Mears says the tourists eat it up.
They love it. At the cabin coffee house, she had these table tents, you know, you normally have desserts or whatever. She put Atacama tent in Ojibwe, animals of the North Woods in Ojibwe, Red Lake Seven Clans in Ojibwe.
She ran with it.
Yeah, yeah, and she even put stuff on the menu in Ojibwe. And people were stealing these things out of the table tents during the summer. They'd steal them. So what she decided was to make a bunch of put them by the cash register and give them away.
I have to say, when Michael told me this, some alarms went off in my head. I picture non-native tourists coming to town seeking out bits of Indian culture like they're birdwatching, looking for something rare and exotic. Is this even in part a gimmick to attract tourists? So I tell Michael.
That is so interesting. Like, on one hand, it's like, I would steal that off the table. I would love to, like, let's talk about one in Ojibwe.
Yeah.
At the same time, it's like, when you say, like, oh, the tourists eat it up, it's like, oh, we've crossed back over into exploitation.
The difference is it has to be authentic. And when I was a kid, and my folks used to go up north to a resort, we'd go through Mille Lacs, and they had this powwow ring where Indians are dancing, and they've got on the Dakota headdresses, and they're pretending, they're acting it out. So it was for the tourists, but this is authentic, and that's the difference. It's got to be authentic.
Over the past 50 years, efforts like the Ojibwe Signage Project have made American Indians more visible, less demonized, less romanticized. From the historic boycott of Bemidji businesses,
all tribal and cap purchases in the Bemidji area are being halted temporarily,
to the historic Bay Mijigamaag celebration.
We come together today to share in the positive spirit of the powwow, the good life. I hope the friendships that we make here today will grow beyond this event, and our community will continue on a path of inclusiveness and respect for one another.
And now there's a new group gathering.
All of that still doesn't fix kind of endemic issues around poverty and, you know, policing and so forth.
Anton Troyer with the American Indian Resource Center at Bemidji State is involved in the new truth and reconciliation efforts emerging in Bemidji.
But what it does do is it gets everyone to the table so we can have a shared process. And that's the key.
A shared process focused on changing the public systems, education, healthcare, law enforcement, that he says continue to miss the mark when serving Native people. We'll hear stories from that effort in the next half hour. For this special edition of Minnesota Native News, I'm Melissa Townsend. Special thanks to Aaron Warhol, Diane Richard, and Marie Rock.
Minnesota Native News is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.